Hey everyone, welcome to episode 22 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. If this is your first time listening, thanks for tuning in. The Historic Performance Podcast is published every Tuesday and Thursday, and notes from today's show and all previous episodes can be found at www.historicperformance.net/podcast. You can connect with me via Twitter at historicperform. There I publish all the latest episodes and give you the opportunity to recommend future guests to the podcast. In today's episode, I chat with Tony Joyle. He is the head strength and conditioning coach for the New York Red Bulls, who just finished a very successful season where they made it to the Eastern Conference Finals, where unfortunately they fell to the Columbus Crew. In today's episode, we talk about a variety of topics, but we particularly focus on college soccer. He talks about his time at the University of Louisville, his thoughts about program design and load management for college soccer players. And then finally, we end up talking a little bit about his time in Major League Soccer. It's a really interesting episode. I think you're really going to like it, especially if you're involved with college athletics. Let's get the show started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today, I'm excited to have Tony Joyle with me from the New York Red Bulls. He's the head of strength and conditioning there. They're having a fantastic year. Tony, how are you?
Hi, James. I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well on my end. I'm really excited to have you on and to talk a little bit about your time at the University of Louisville within their strength and conditioning department, and also about your time at the Chicago Fire.
Okay.
To start us off, can you give us a little bit of background about yourself, a little bit about your story and how you ended up in Major League Soccer?
So I grew up in France, born in Auxerre, in 2 hours away from Paris, played in the academy system there for many years. Started at 5 years old, like almost most of the kids in France, and then played there all the way to 20, 21 years old. So 15 to 16 years in the club. So I had the chance to play with some good players there. I wasn't, unfortunately, not good enough to make it to the pro team. So close, but just didn't happen. So I always, you know, focused on the studies more because my dream was to work in soccer. So I found a way. I wasn't able to play at the highest level, so I found a way to get to the game. So I went to the University of Burgundy, where I studied exercise science. So I did 4 years there. I was fortunate, you know, in France, it's a little bit different when you get to the university. Like after high school, you have to make choices in your education, and you go. It's pretty specific right away when you go to exercise science. From your freshman year, all you talk about is, you know, anatomy and exercise physiology, nutrition. From you're done with the English class, sorry, not English classes, but French literature and math, and you focus really on exercise science from your first year at the school. So, and I spent 4 years there, and I was fortunate to do internship as well. We had like a performance center at the University of Burgundy where we were doing some research on soccer. And so I spent 4 years there. When I was done with my bachelor, we did a little study on neuromuscular fatigue. We simulated a soccer game and we tested players at before the game, obviously, before the simulation, and then at halftime and at the end of the game. And we were looking at the difference in strengths for the quadriceps and hamstrings in concentric and eccentric contraction before the game, at halftime, and also after the game. And we wanted to publish these studies, and the publication, you know, it's done in English mainly. So with my friend, we couldn't speak any English at that time, and my professor had some publication, but he wanted us to start the writing process and to get the experience in it. And so I decided at that time we had a partnership with the University of Burgundy and University of Kentucky in Lexington. So I decided to take advantage on that. And I came for like a 6-month English program in Lexington. And I studied English there. And from there, I kind of discovered the college games. Because when you're in Europe and, you know, you watch all the professional soccer games there, you have, I didn't even know college soccer existed at that time. And I came to the US and I discovered college sports. And after my studies and I spent 6 months there, I'd like to, you know, to try maybe to study in the US a little bit more and work with a college team. So I sent a couple of emails at that time. I reached out to University of Kentucky men's soccer coach, University of Louisville, different school in Kentucky. And the head coach from University of Louisville at that time, Ken Lola, wrote me back and said, "Oh, I like your profile and I would like to meet up with you." And I went to Louisville. I met up with him. And he didn't offer me a job right away, but he said, "Look, if you want, you can come in January. We have the spring season and you can start working with us. As a volunteer, you can show us, you know, what you would like to do with the team." And we go from there. So he was very open-minded to bring me in, and that was excellent for me. And when I got there, I applied for graduate school at the same time at University of Louisville. And it was a good timing for me because they were looking to bridge a gap between the exercise physiology laboratory and also the strength and conditioning department. And they were looking for someone that was able to work in the lab and also to be with the teams and do some strength and conditioning with the Olympic team. So men's soccer, women's soccer, lacrosse, field hockey, and so on. So after volunteering for 4 months, for all the spring semesters, and I got a graduate assistantship and I started my master in exercise physiology with Louisville. And I spent a year and a half there. And then I got the job with Chicago Fire. They were looking for a fitness coach at that time. So I got the job with Chicago. I stayed there for 4 years. And now I'm with New York Red Bulls.
It's a pretty fascinating one that you started off at collegiate athletics. And I know that many people, especially since I bring in a lot of Europeans, they aren't aware of college soccer, as you mentioned. And the college soccer is a bit different than what many people perceive because it's a very short season. There's many of games going on. It's a very short preseason. It's usually 2 weeks. And there's a lot of rules because first and foremost, these players are students and then they're athletes. Could you give us a little bit of information of the transition into college athletics? Was it scary for you, intimidating for you the first day that you showed up as a volunteer? And how did you begin to slowly mold into a more permanent position?
Yeah, I think first of all, it was a cultural shock because, like you said, the rules are so different and the way the season is set was completely new for me. And I had a hard time understanding, like, okay, I started in the spring, so we have times that you can touch the ball and do like soccer activities, but you have time where you're not allowed to touch the ball and you just do strength and conditioning without the ball. So that was very confusing at first. So, but it was fascinating as well. And that was actually my biggest challenge, to come to the US and start working with a team with all these rules and all this new, the new setup. And you know, if you start with a preseason, because the whole spring was basically to get guys ready for the preseason. And we have some testing that we were doing. And what I was fortunate with, I was working with the Polar system when I was in France. And when I got to the University of Louisville, they just got the Polar Team 2 system at that time. So that was already 7 to 8 years ago. Not a lot of teams were using it. And I think coaches at that time, they weren't so sure what to do with the data either. So what I did with the data is with the Polar system was basically I told the fitness staff and the head coach that, you know, basically in France, this is what I've been doing with the heart rate data. And we started to do a test. It was called like a Vameval, and it's basically an incremental test around, you know, around the track, and you get to a maximal velocity at the end that we call the MAV, maximal aerobic velocity. And that's a velocity where you reach VO2 max, basically. And at the end, you reach your heart rate max as well. So when we did the test, I showed them, you know, the heart rate max of each players and the velocity that they reach at the end of the test. And then I kind of build up the whole conditioning based on that. And I was using different exercises such as 30-30, for example, 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, or 15-15. And we were using the percentage of the velocity at VO2 max at that time. So for example, we were doing the 30-30 exercise. We were using 100% of the velocity they reached at the test. And if we were doing a 15-15, it was a little bit faster. Maybe we were doing 100 or 105%. So when we were changing the intervals, the speed changed and it was very individualized. And then we were getting heart rate response for the players from these fitness exercises. So I think the coaches enjoy that because, you know, we try to be on top of the players and try to monitor as much as we could. And then that led us to the preseason. When we got to the preseason, I was surprised and, you know, everything gets crazy right away. I mean, we do the fitness testing and then you start to train right away. On the first day, you do two sessions. Second day, you do two sessions. And then Thursday, sometimes you keep going. You know, every time I talk to college coaches, I try to tell them how, first of all, how stressful it is to do like a maximal test, you know, when you get to your maximal heart rate. And sometimes they see it as only 12 to 15 minutes test, but it's more stressful because you get to your to exertion at the end of the test. And I think in college soccer, it's very easy to do too much too early because you have only 2 weeks of preseason. And I think coaches try to accomplish a lot of things. They want to get the players fit. They want to, you know, they want to get the team fit. And you end up doing two sessions a day. Sometimes I heard, you know, teams doing three sessions a day as well for consecutive days. And I think you add a lot of fatigue early on. And then it's hard to have your 2 weeks of training at a good quality. Then the quality just decreases. So I think it's important for fitness coaches that work in college team to try to educate the head coaches. And I like the rhythm of, I don't know what you do with your team, but in preseason, but I always like the rhythm of the first day you do two sessions, the second day you would do two sessions. And then on the third day, I back off and do only one like recovery type of session. And then I go again, two sessions, and then back off again. And I try to base that, you know, on the game as well. You know, if you have two games during your preseason or three games, I try to plan my week of training based on that. But I like the routine of 2-2, and then back off, 2-2, back off. That's, I feel like, works the best. And then, you know, when we were doing all this testing, we had players, we put them in buckets, fit versus unfit players. And we were doing sometimes with unfit players even more conditioning because obviously they were not as fit as the other ones. But the problem with that is someone that is unfit is not ready to absorb the load of the training session already because he's not ready for it. But then you start to add even a higher load on him because you want him to be fitter. And that's detrimental for the athlete, and I don't think they develop as much when you start doing that. You add a lot of fatigue early on, and it's almost, you know, I'm sure you guys know that, but it's almost where the fitter you are, the more training you can do, and when you unfit, it's very hard to absorb the loads of the college preseason. So it's even harder when you start to add a more training session for them, you know, to get them fit and so on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then, you know, throughout the season, it's tricky as well because you start to have a lot of games, you know, with two games a week for consecutive weeks. And then you end up having, you know, your reserve group and then your starting group and how do you handle the reserve training is very important, I think, because you end up having a group of 5, 6 or sometimes 10 players. And it's almost the same. It's always, you know, the same guys you're dealing with. And if you look at their week of training from a loading standpoint, they end up doing a lot of small solid games because that's just what you have in terms of numbers. You have, you know, day after the game, 2 days after the game, you have 10 guys. So basically you do a technical work and then you end up doing small solid games, you know, 5v5 or 4v4 games. And I think they do, you know, they do a lot of change of direction, a high number of acceleration, deceleration. and they miss out on the velocity component of the training. And so I think for fitness coaches, when they deal with reserves, and it's important to open up at some point. You know, even they can still do the 4v4, 5v5 games to get them the change of direction and acceleration, deceleration. But it's very important to have them open up as well to get a different stimuli for them that matches the game a little bit more.
I'm really glad that you highlighted some points about the college game, especially for some of the listeners that might not know about it. And I do agree, something that you said that's extremely critical is you have this off-season period, which is the summer. And during that time, many colleges will provide the players with a program. Now, part of the issue is there enough buy-in from the players? How are the players actually going to do it? And I find that it varies. And I've heard from other podcasts that this even happens in the professional setting in certain teams where they get their off-season work and you have people that do it, people that kind of do it, and then people that don't do it at all. And it obviously reflects when they come in the preseason. But yeah, then you have this 2-week narrow period of time. And like you said, people that are unfit are not going to be able to handle that load. And then there's an increased risk for injury. My question to you would be, when you had these unfit players, you said that you put them in two different buckets. How strenuously would you increase the conditioning given the conditions?
Yeah, I think when you have a player that comes and fit, I think the loads of the training sessions that you do is plenty for them already. The only time you can do more with them is actually the next couple of weeks. So you do your 2 weeks of preseason and they just do the training from the team, and that's going to be plenty of loads for them. And then when you get to your season, and then it's going to depend if they start or not, but if they're not as fit as the other players, maybe they're not going to be able to start and play a lot of minutes. So now the training sessions are going to be a little bit lighter in terms of loads. So that's when I would do the extra conditioning with them. It's actually when the loads of the trainings are a little bit lighter, and now you can extend them. Because if you try to do things in the first 2 weeks, you just burn them out because it's going to be too much too early. And the problem with too much too early, you can get fit quicker sometimes, but you don't know how long they're going to be able to maintain it for. And I think that's the key, and that's why it's important in preseason to be able to progress your teams into the fitness, because doing too much too early, you get them fit maybe at the peak early on, but then you're not so sure how long they can maintain it throughout the season. And sometimes towards the end of the season, you just see a crash in your players. And so I think being able to progress them throughout the preseason gives you a better chance to be fit for a longer time. You may get fit a little bit later, but at least you're able to maintain it for the full college season.
At the University of Louisville, you mentioned that they're trying to integrate more of strength and conditioning along with exercise physiology. What, beyond the polar heart rates, were you using wellness questionnaires with the players? Were there any other type of things that you're doing in order to monitor load?
We were tracking the wellness questionnaire, and also with sleep quantity. And it was hard. We were doing it at that time, but it was always on paper, and we had to, you know, it was 8 years ago. We didn't have as much app as now. And I think now it's evolved a lot. And I think in college soccer, they're able to use, and I suggest to use, you know, the one we use with New York Red Bulls Fit for 90, or that is pretty easy to use for the players, and you get excellent information on players' readiness for training and for games. We were doing it at that time, but doing it on paper was very hard to be able to collect all the information. And
yeah, and I know I've talked with Dr. John Cohen from Fit for 90. He's a really great guy, and everyone who I've heard has used Fit for 90 has been really happy with the product. So I'm glad you mentioned it. I want to transition a little bit into off the field work in the college setting. In terms of your gym-based strength and conditioning session, so we're going to the gym and actually lifting weights, what would it look like in the preseason, and what would it look like in season if you're doing any sessions at all?
Great question. I think it's important for fitness coaches at first to have and this is very hard because I know in college you work with multiple teams. You know, you may have 4 or 5 teams. I think trying to understand the game and the demands of the game are very important. And I give you an example when, because what I've seen in college is, you know, I've seen the soccer team was doing a practice session and I was with a fitness coach inside working with another team. And then 2 hours later, the soccer team is coming and we had no idea what happened on the soccer field. And then we start doing lifting session without knowing what happened on the field, really. The way this can change, I think, and it may have changed the last couple of years, but I think what's important is to be on the same page from a terminology standpoint with the coaches. And I give you like simple terms for strength and conditioning coach to kind of understand the game and to understand what the laws of a soccer trainings are. And as simple as it is, when a quick communication with the coaches in terms of, oh, I saw, what does the session look today from a soccer standpoint? And they're going to tell you, all right, so today we're going to warm up for 10 minutes, do some agility in there. Then we're going to do maybe some technical work. Then we go to a possession game. So when you say possession game, ask them, what numbers do you use? Is it a 3v3 plus 3, for example, possession? Is it a 5v5? Is it a 10v10 possession game? What is the size of the field? Is it tight? Is it medium space? Is it a big space? And then the last part, usually it's the playing phase, you know, and the last part of the training. So same question, how many players are in your teams? Is it a 4v4? Is it 8v8? Is it 10v10? Was it a small field, medium field, big field? And from that, it's going to give you a lot of information on what they're targeting in the training session, because if they did possession games where everything was tight and it was small numbers of games, you're looking at a strength day, what we call strength from a soccer standpoint. And it's basically a day where if you look at GPS data from this day, you're going to get a lot of change of direction with a high number of acceleration, deceleration. And when you do that, you know that they targeted mostly quads and abductors. So by knowing that, when you get the team after training, you know that it's probably not the day to do squatting movements and, you know, just targeting pushing movement with the quads and so on. On the other side, if it's a day where they did patterns, what we call patterns to goal, you know, it's like functional work where you do some combinations, they attack, they do some finishing, you have longer sprints in it, maybe like a right back or outside back, they do like 50-yard sprint to get to the ball before they cross it. I mean, or if they play like a 10v10 games, 11-11, and it's on full field or three quarters of the field. So now you know that from a stress standpoint, they're targeting more like the posterior chain. And it was more what we call a speed day from a fitness standpoint. And you targeted the posterior chain. So now when you get to the weight room, how do you deal with that? Do you target the posterior chain again? Or do you kind of balance that? These are questions that needs to be answered. But I think to have the same terminology with the coaches and to have an understanding of what they're targeting in the training session, I think that's going to help designing your strength session in the weight room, because you can have a choice. So if you know during the week, let's say you have a full week of training and you know you play on Saturday, let's say Saturday, Sunday, you're going to do your recovery, for example. Monday may be your day off. When you come on Tuesday and you have the training sessions, that may be what we call a strength day. You know, they may do some small solid games, like I said. So it's important for you to communicate with the coaching staff and having simple terms like that. Like, all right, today is going to be a strength day. Wednesday, you 3 days before the game, it may be one of the day where we do like more endurance type of day. Maybe we open up, we play bigger number in a bigger space, and you. That's going to be your highest volume of training. Now you're looking at a session like 90 minutes type of session, for example. Then the 2 days before the game can be your speed type of day. Maybe they do patterns to goal. You get to top speed, which is very important. Sometimes it's hard for coaches to get players at top speed. And 2 days before the game can be a day to work on that. And then you have, you know, the day before would be a traditional, you know, day before the game type of training. So to make it simple, I think, you know, working on the terminology and being able to communicate like that would be helpful for fitness coaches to design the strength exercises that you use. to go back to your question on what kind of exercises in season versus preseason, what we ended up doing, you know, when, and I'm sure a lot of coaches do the FMS and they're able to define the needs for the team. Maybe some teams do it more individually. Sometimes it's more like team oriented, but when you get your data, you can put players in different buckets based on the needs. And I think we do a lot of what we call movement prep. You know, it can be hip mobility work, hamstring flexibility, ankle mobility. So we do all this work beforehand, and then we have different core exercises or lower body or upper body depending on the days. And then we have the training session afterwards. That's how I would design it. Sometimes you can do your strengths after training as well. I think it just depends on, in college soccer, it depends a lot on your schedule as well. You know, when the team gets in the weight room and you kind of have to adapt. You don't have a lot of choices on that.
Yeah, college soccer definitely is a lot of adaptability. I'm really glad you brought up the idea of communication because, as you mentioned, a strength and conditioning coach in the college setting may not necessarily just specialize in one particular sport. So they may get a sport that they have never worked with before. They've never played on themselves. They initially don't know the physical demands of the game. So it is important for them to gain an understanding of that and also to be able to speak what I like to say, coach, because I think a lot of times, especially strength conditioning coaches, fitness coaches, sports scientists, we love what we do, but we can't talk the same way when we're talking, interacting with a coach. Cause I mean, they're not A, they're probably not going to want to hear it. And B, they don't need to know all the information that we do. Can you give them the basics so that that way they can, or they are the ones who are the experts in terms of tactical and technical sessions? Can they design it in a way, especially in a college setting, can they design it in a way that they feel comfortable, but the strength and conditioning staff also feels comfortable from an injury prevention standpoint?
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's why I think being able to manage the loads and being able to communicate with them on even injury prevention, when you look at it, it's a lot based on the loads of the training session as well. And sometimes it's almost the head coach and the assistant coaches, they are almost the main fitness coaches when they make decisions in terms of training. Because I know in the college settings, they are probably the one, you know, when they play a 4v4 game, they are the one decided if, do we play it 3x6? Is it 4x4 minutes? Is it, you know, is it 2x8? They are the one making all these decisions. And that's the key, you know, that's the main stress that they're going to put on the athlete. And that's, at the end of the day, that's how they develop the fitness. And by doing too much or not enough, or it's, they may, you know, put players at risk for injuries. So it's always finding the balance of giving the right stimuli for the players. But I think it's important for the fitness coach to be able to communicate and help the coaching staff, you know, to define the loads day by day and also weekly to have players fresh for the game. Because at the end of the day, that's what we want. We want players fresh for the game. To perform well, and also we want players to give them a chance to recover before we hit them with another hard training session. Because what I've seen a lot as well in the college setting, I think we train a lot between games as well, you know, and I think we're so limited on time because you play two games a week and you don't have a lot of training session to prepare the team, that sometimes we don't give a chance for the players to recover enough before you do another hard training session. And especially the 2 days after the game, because I've seen a lot when I remember some teams, we were playing Friday, Sunday, and then we had the Monday off. And then the Tuesday training session, I know the players were not recovered yet from the weekend because you're looking at, you know, 2 days after the game. And we were doing a hard training session on that day at times. And I think when you get to that that rhythm, you start to add fatigue to a player that is already fatigued. So I think the key there is making sure they recover from it before you start to do another, you know, high intensity or high volume training session.
I would like to transition now to your time with the Chicago Fire. So up to this point, your exposure had been in the college setting. Now you're transitioning from the college setting, which has these restrictions, to Major League Soccer. Did you experience any challenges when you initially made that transition?
So, you know, it's a good question because it was more challenging for me to go to college soccer than it was to go to professional soccer. And I think it just based on my background, because coming from Europe, all I was used to is, and all I learned about when I studied the game was, you start the season, you have 6 to 8 weeks of preseason, then you're going to play one game a week. You have 4 or 5 training days before the game. And, you know, you play for 10 months and then you have a month off and then you go again in the same cycle. So that's what I learned and that's what I was used to. When I got to the college game, was a challenging part because of what we talked about. The preseason is 2 weeks and then you have all these games and it's only 3 months and then you have the spring season. So that was a challenging part to me. When I got to the professional game, I was used to this type of schedule and this longer preseason. And so I felt like I was more in a, that was more what I was used to. So it wasn't challenging at all. The challenge was, I was young when I started, obviously. I was 25 when I had my, the position with Chicago. And, you know, I talked a lot with the players, tried to explain what I wanted to do. They needed to hear it even more than, college players. I think you college players, it's a little bit easier. You still explain a lot to them, but it's easier to have everybody on the same page doing what you expect them to do. With a professional team, players have so many different backgrounds and different cultures, and that you have to explain a little bit more what you're looking at and how what you're doing is going to help them from an individual standpoint and also as a team standpoint. Also, being able to individualize the training loads were key. You know, I was used to in the college game, as we talked about, it's, you know, you have players between, I would say, 18 to 22 years old. And I think they respond to training a little bit the same way. I would put the freshman in another category, but most of the players respond to training the same way at that age. And then when you get to the professional team, it's, you know, you have players from like now it's 18 to 35 years old sometimes. So that makes a big difference. Another big difference I faced was the recovery after the game. You know, I talked to you about the college game and how sometimes we could train 2 days after the game. In yes. Professional soccer, it's a little bit different because when you play the game, just everything is the load, you know, the load of the game, the speed of play, the emotions, the stress from the game, everything is at a higher level compared to college soccer. And I think, so the stress is so much higher than they need a little bit more time to recover. So now the second day, when you look at the training session, you have to be very careful because now you're 100% sure they haven't recovered from the game, especially if you travel and so on. So managing these 2 days after the game was very different compared to college soccer and professional. You know, I can touch a little bit on the 2 days after the game, what it can look like, because for fitness coaches and sometimes the teams are going to train and play soccer. So I think it's important for strength and conditioning coaches, if they want to relate to the coaching staff, it's to do things where you can get the heart rate up at that time and you can do soccer activities, but you have to be able to control it. And maybe it's more rest between the reps. The speed of it should be a little bit controlled and good ways to do it. I give you an example of what we do now, like 2 days after the game. We're going to do maybe some technical work at first. And then when we get to a game, we're going to use small goals. We're not going to use any big goals. So that way you limit the shooting and the sprinting and the high intensity burst to get to goal. So you limit that by using small goals. And you use usually medium numbers, which is sometimes 7v7 or 8v8. If you have a big number of players, I would use three teams of eight. That way you have 2 teams playing, another team maybe doing on the outside some hip mobility work or like a movement prep type of work, and then you rotate your team. So by doing that, you kind of in control of the stress that you put on the players. You get a loading on them, but it's you limit the number of acceleration deceleration, and you also limit the number of sprints. So that's what it can look like. So that was a big difference there compared to college soccer. With them, it was also creating a culture in the weight room. You know, in college soccer, I think it's especially in the US, guys like to go to the weight room and work out and getting stronger. And I think it's a mentality. But when I got with Chicago Fire, at that time, the first year and even second and third year, we had players from different background, and they were not used to get in the weight room. You know, they didn't know about the movement prep and hip mobility type of work. And they were sometimes used to long training session as well. You know, they come from, I give you examples, even players coming from Mexico or Argentina, and they used to, it's a lower intensity in the training, but longer training session. Sometimes they would work with a fitness coach for an hour, and they would do another 2 hours with the technical staff. And so it was training session of 2 or 3 hours. And so just different backgrounds. So you have to adapt, communicate a lot, and explain, you know, what you're looking for, and show them that it's going to help them to perform and be the best, because that's what they want to know at the end of the day.
When we're talking about the culture in the weight room, and you have people from all different types of cultures, Central America, South America, some Europeans, some Americans, how do you go about having the players buy into that process, especially for someone who may have been playing and never been in a weight room situation for maybe 7-8 years of their career?
Yeah, I think it's important to, there is no like right answer in terms of all the environments are different and very different. I was fortunate in Chicago. I had the most experienced players, and our best players were players that took care of themselves from a professional standpoint. So they were the first one in, and they got in the weight room early on, and they, you know, early to do some movement prep to prepare for training. Then they were doing the training session, and after training, they were coming to the weight room. They were doing some recovery strategies and also some strength training depending on the days. And these 3 or 4 players were like the top players of my team. So I almost use them to kind of get the groups together and creating this culture. Right now, the team I'm working with, it's a little bit different because the main guys, they don't come to the weight room that much yet. And so it's just a different environment. So I have to find a way to, you know, find, like you say, how do you get to do that? You have to observe your team and know your players and communicate. At some point, you find a way. But for me in Chicago, it was easier because my main players were already doing it. So it was easier to get the group together. And then I was using the younger players to start from an early age to get them in the weight room, give them programs and target different, you know, being very specific with them. And the other players saw that and they wanted to know a little bit more about it. And then it's a lot of communication, some, you know, using the FMS and showing the data from it. And this is the kind of exercises that can help you to work on this. And then they were buying into it. And at the end, we created a culture. Like, they understood that there was something that needed to be done before training. The time of going to the locker room, get taped, and then go to the soccer field and start practicing is kind of over. And now the being a professional means you come in, you know, early in the morning, you get your treatments, and you come to the weight room and you do some movement prep type of work, working on different deficiencies or strengths that you may have. When they start to understand that, I think you have your group in a good way, and then you get to the training session. But once they understand that there is always something that needs to be done before training to prepare for training, that's the key with a professional team. And it takes time to develop a culture like that. It takes at least 1 or 2 years for sure.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think it's pretty smooth transition into our next topic, which is you came into the New York Red Bulls when they're ready within their season. I believe you joined in August, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
That's when
early August, yeah.
Albert had left to take up his university position in Barcelona. So what advice would you have for someone who is just coming into a team and they're already in season, they're already used to something? Do you just keep things the same way in order not to disrupt the flow? Or how did you go about the process?
Yeah, so first of all, I was fortunate that the former fitness coach used methods that I was using as well. I think we have kind of the same philosophy when it comes to fitness and soccer training. So what I try to do, I try to make it as smooth as I could for the players. And I kept things the way they were doing it. And, you know, the warm-up before training, the pre-game warm-up, recovery sessions, I kept everything the same. I haven't changed anything. And it's not easy to do because, you know, there are some days like I'm just putting on paper what I'm going to do. And I have ideas that, you know, on the style I coach and things that I want to do. And sometimes it's a challenge because I want to keep the things going. So I think that's key to make it as smooth as you can for the players. And I think the players appreciated that as well. You know, it wasn't the time to come in and try right away to put my methods in and change, you know, a couple of things. It wasn't the right time. So trying to make it smooth and then start to develop different things, you know, step by step. Try to develop, you know, a sports science program, looking at what we have, what needs to be a little bit better, and, you know, what can we develop in the club. Then looking at what they were doing before training as well. And, you know, I talked to you about getting the young players, and now before training, I start to have guys already coming to the weight room and start doing some different exercises to get ready for training. So I started with, you know, it's always with the younger players, and it's harder with the main guys, I would say, the main players, because, you know, they are in a routine already, and I came so late in August, the last 3 or 4 months. So it wasn't the time to, you know, to get one of the best player and say, look, we're going to need to do things a little bit differently. So it was a little bit easier for me to take the younger players or players that didn't play as much and try to start to show them and kind of develop a culture with them. And now I have more and more players in the weight room doing different things, you know, even the strength after training. And now even the main players that I mentioned, they come and ask me, you know, what can I do after training to work on different things. So it's a start. And the thing, you know, I try to keep everything the same, like I said. The thing that I've been doing differently, and it's just because I didn't know how the former coach was doing it, but it's more the re-athletization. So when, you know, when you have players injured and getting him back on the field, I think I'm able to do things that I've done just because I'm not so sure what was done before, you know, for that. So, and I can use like specific functional exercises based on the positions that I do. And I've been enjoying that part a lot. And also the training with small groups, you know, I can be myself a little bit and do the exercises that I've seen success with and so on. So, but it's challenging for sure. I didn't have a lot of time to think about it because it all came quick, the change of position. But it's very challenging to come in a team that, you know, has been together for 5 or 6 months and is making a push, you know, for the MLS Cup. So that's a great experience.
Tony, what is the structure like at the Red Bulls? I know each club is different. Some have a sports scientist, then a strength and conditioning coach and a fitness coach, but you're the head of strength and conditioning at the Red Bulls. Do you also have a sports scientist and someone who just works on on-field fitness, or do you do both the on-field fitness and the gym-based SNC?
Yeah, I do both right now. I'm going to look to develop the program for sure, but I do both. What I try to do is being very efficient. I try to be as efficient as I can with my time. You know, I come early in the morning, try to get with the coaching staff and talk about training, what needs to be done from a loading standpoint. Then, you know, try to help on how long the training is and so on. And then try to set up the field as early as I can before the players get in. Because once the players get in, I want to be in the weight room around like 10, because I have from 10 to 10:30 to do some work with them before training starts. Then it's, you know, I'm on the field working with the players. Then after training, I get, you know, all the GPS and get the guys, you know, cool down. Some guys do some extra work. Then I get back on, you know, in the gym. Some players may want to do some strengthening. Some players are under specific programs, and I work with them. And then after training, it's looking at the data and start to do some analysis and so on. So busy days, but as so far, I'm right now I'm the only one strength and conditioning coach, and we have one we have a USL team here as well. So we have a fitness coach for the USL team, and also for the academy, we have a fitness coach as well.
But you're also doing the sports science, so you're doing the analysis of the data yourself.
I do, yes.
Okay. Now to transition to the final part of the podcast, there's a couple of things that I want to touch upon. First is you recently started your own website and you came out with an ebook. I was hoping if you could talk to the audience a little bit about what your ebook has and what its target audience is.
Yeah, so the last couple of years, I've been doing a lot of passing exercises during warm-ups. And I think sometimes fitness coaches, you have different type of fitness coaches, obviously. And I've tried to learn a lot about the game, and I'm still learning because the way I see myself, I couldn't be a fitness coach for another sport just because I want to learn as much as I can about the sport, and it's, I try to make it very specific. And this book that I put together is 50 warm-up exercises using the ball to get the players ready for training. And the website is, Tony Jouot, which is my first name, last name, .com. And I have a couple of papers I'm working on. So on this, you would find different exercises. I'm working on some positional speed exercises as well, and especially for college soccer, because I know we have a lot of time without the ball in the spring, and sometimes we're looking at different speed exercises. And so I'm putting something together right now about different specific movement based on the position, attacking movement versus defending movements, and working on footwork in a way that is very specific to the game. So that's what I want to develop on my website. It's going to be more like an educational tool and just resources for the coaches. It can be soccer coaches and also fitness coaches, obviously.
That sounds fantastic. When I publish the podcast, I'm going to link your information below. That way all the listeners can easily access it and look at your website.
Perfect. Thank you.
Next question. Part of the reason that I created this podcast is to give advice to younger fitness coaches that are just starting off their career. They may just be graduating from university, have done a couple of internships. What recommendations would you have for them?
I think every time I listen to a podcast, it's pretty good what people say. They talk about reaching out to other coaches, and everybody is open, and that's for sure. Emailed everyone and so on. What I want to talk about is how to get better as a fitness coach. I think it's key as well. And a lot of things that I've tried to do is every day after the training session, I write down a lot. I get feedbacks a lot on the training and the exercises I do, and just writing down. And I think there is a power there of learning, because even today, you can work with professional team. I make so many mistakes. So every day, I write down, and it's basically it's when I make a mistake, it's trying to write it down just to see what went wrong and try to find why. And even when I do an exercise, why it didn't work or why did it work well, write it down. And then I think it's going to take you to another level, because then you start learning the process and it all comes together and you limit your mistakes. And I think that's a good way to get better. And another thing I would mention is, go get the job that you dream about, because sometimes, we get, it's easy to get discouraged because there is not a lot of jobs out there like the one we want to do, but the one we want to do are usually the ones that a lot of people want to do sometimes. But don't get discouraged, because there is opportunity for everyone. There is no reason why one is better than another. So it's learning, being passionate about it, dedicated, reaching out to people, and finding a way to get in. And sometimes, for some people, it was quick. I had the chance to go. I mentioned I was 25 when I started. So sometimes it goes so quick, but sometimes it takes more time. Sometimes it's you have to do more internship and get on in different way. But there is always a way. So I was encouraged to stay on top of it and get the job of your dream.
I'm really glad you said that, especially the part about mistakes. I interview a lot of well-known strength conditioning coaches, fitness coaches that have significantly more experience than I do, and they all say, "Don't be afraid to make a mistake." You know, as long as you don't do anything, what a lot of them say, stupid, that's going to get someone hurt. You know, it's okay to make mistakes and learn from them because that's how you become a better coach.
Exactly.
Tony, if anyone has any questions, comments to reach out to you, what is the best way that they can contact you? I know that you now have your website. Is that a good way to contact you?
It is a good way because on the website you can actually email me directly from it. So that's a good way. And then I'm on Twitter as well at Tony Jouos, so first name, last name. So that would be the two ways to contact me.
Fantastic, Tony. Thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, James.
Thanks for tuning in today. If you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to leave a review and rating on iTunes. It really helps others discover the show. If you enjoyed today's content, make sure to head over to Tony's website, which is www.tonyjouaux.com. He has some fantastic information there, as well as two ebooks. Hope you enjoy it. And see you next time.